Greetings and welcome to the Library's Lead and the New Normal podcast. This is the fifth podcast of our second season with our star-studded lineup of Beth Potan, assistant professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies, the fabulous Mike Eisenberg, founding dean and faculty emeritus from the University of Washington's iSchool, and me, myself and I, Dave Lankus, the Bowden Professor of Librarianship at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you for listening to our Library's Lead podcast. Please keep spreading the word. Send us feedback at info@libraryslead.org and review us on your favorite podcast app, unless it's Spotify, in which case I hope you know you haven't taken your music catalog offline. And we are grateful to our academic sponsors, the University of Texas iSchool and the Syracuse University iSchool, and of course, ACE Chicago Events. Hi, Beth. Hi, Mike. Beth, please remind us of why we're here.
Hi, all. So first, we're here because of our listeners, right? And so before I remind us of why we're here, I just want to say that this week we got to 1,500 downloads, which is pretty great. So thanks to all of y'all that are listening and downloading. So as we've been saying, the last 2 years have been hard on us all, and it seems like there have been some life-altering, transformative changes taking place. We talk about various aspects of life, work, fun, and what are or might be the unique roles and opportunities for libraries and librarians to help people in this new and includes a what's up from each of us, a deeper dive into a main topic, and as always, we end with awesome library thingies. So let's get right to it. Dave, what's up with you?
Well, I've been adjusting to life as a Texan, which is apparently consists of driving at 80 miles an hour, which is the legal speed limit on the toll roads, at 300 feet off the ground in deep fog. So it's been interesting. And I had this sort of moment where I've realized that I have, in fact, given over to Skynet, and I am now a servant under the control of Waze, the navigation app, because I was about to cross over to the other side of the city, and I got on this lovely toll road. Everything's a toll road here. And Waze suddenly decided it couldn't connect to the internet. And so I'm at 80 miles an hour, 300 feet off the ground on a toll road in the deep fog without Waze. And I just had this image of suddenly ending up at the Mexican border with $300 owed to the state of Texas. Luckily, I was able to pull over to the side. And I don't know, of course, there's some sort of deep fried chicken place that I could stop and reset my phone and get it in working. So it's been that kind of week. So I wish I could say that there was something much more thoughtful and in-depth, but primarily it's been me attempting not to die on the roadways. So there you go. That's what I got. What's up with you, Beth?
Well, not dying is good, so that's good. I have two this week, and they're both pretty big. So my first one is that my first book chapter got published, and I actually got the physical copy of the book in my hand, which was a really exciting moment. So my chapter is called The Miseducation of the Library, and it's kind of an ode to Carter G. Woodson's The Miseducation of the Negro, and because he told us 100 years ago that we are miseducating ourselves. And so kind of looking at how we've continued to miseducate ourselves within the library field. So I'm super happy to have that in my hands. And this is a big one. So last week I talked about my grandmother, Martha Herford, and today is the first day of Black History Month, and my grandfather made a documentary, and I'm going to publish it online on our Rocket City Civil Rights website. And before I do that, I wanted to make sure it had captions so it could be accessible. And even though I've watched this documentary, like, you know, my family made me watch it a million times, it felt like, because I was captioning it, I listened to it over and over again. And thinking about my grandmother getting arrested, and I talked about the sit-ins last week, but what I never really thought about is, like, they were actually successful at that. So I think a lot about school desegregation, but they also desegregated restaurants in the state of Alabama. They were the first Black people to integrate at a white restaurant. And so if you think about going out to eat in the South, every time you see different races eating together in the state, right? My grandparents had something to do with that. And, you know, in thinking about the protest and the civil action that we take to make that progress. But I really hadn't stopped to think about what they had actually accomplished there. And so there was a real big moment for me yesterday in just really thinking about, wow, they were the first Black people to eat at a white restaurant. It's kind of wild. And they integrated parks too. So, like, it's they just on Mother's Day, after church, they were like, let's just go to the park and play. And a couple of families did. And from that day on, the parks were integrated in Huntsville. So just kind of, you know, the bravery and courage, but, you know, thinking about how we share those stories and how we keep bringing it back. So there was some connection from last week, and I found that out last night. So I thought I'd share that.
Great.
Sorry, Mike.
No, I know. I can never follow you, Beth. It's just too much.
We last should switch week, order.
Did I mention 80 miles per hour on the highways here? I think that's, if you don't take anything away.
Yeah. Well, that's uplifting, and it's great. For my what's up, I do have to bring us down a little. Watching the nightly news tonight, just happened to be on. I don't normally watch the nightly news, and of course, the second to final story was about the censorship of school libraries and how people are taking books off in a lot of it in your state, Dave, going after LGBT people. And it's just, I thought we had dealt with this stuff a long time ago, and we're going to pick it up, I think, in our next podcast and go over it. But it was eye-opening, and it's coordinated, and because they're using the same scripts and the same languages. I will have you know that back in 1970. Six, I think it was. I was a teacher librarian in the Syracuse area at a local high school, and I had a censorship challenge and problem. And I reached out for help to a professional organization in the area, and then I was invited to speak to a class at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies. It was my first introduction to the school and the people, and I guess I did okay, because 2 years later they asked me to teach that class, which was media for young adults and stuff. And I don't know, I guess the rest is history. I went on to work at the school, and then a PhD, and so forth. So we can win this. We will win this, because censorship doesn't work, of course, and. Because all it's going to do is to encourage the kids to read the books even more, which is good, but it just doesn't work. Go back and watch, what is it, Footloose or something like that. Censorship doesn't work. So anyway, that's what's up with me.
Censorship brought us Mike Eisenberg's career. So censorship always has good outcomes. I think that's what we're going with this.
Well, the raising of censorship, the fighting against it. How's that, Dave?
No, this is, and I want to be really clear that yes, some things are happening in Texas, but like some things are happening in Colorado, some things are happening in lots of places. And so, yeah, this is, I think, a very important topic for us to take on this podcast, but for us as a profession to talk about leading, we cannot allow the new normal to be the idea that no one can be upset by anything, particularly if they're white. So,
yeah. All right. Well, that was quite the what's up, guys. We're going to take a collect our thoughts moment, take a deep breath, and then come back with our main topic, which tonight is video sharing and so much more. We're going to be talking about YouTube and TikTok and that kind of social media sharing. So, Yanni, give us a quick musical interlude and then. Okay, and welcome back. Let's get to our main topic. If you've been with us for the last few episodes, you know that we dove into the topic of social media, first with an overview discussion of all the issues and some of the substance of it. And then we focused last time in a discussion of Facebook that was troubling, but quite interesting and valuable. In this episode, we switch to what seems to be an easy topic, which is video sharing, the video sharing side of social media, particularly YouTube and TikTok. And I seem to be in the position of giving some of the background, then I'll do that first before we pick up the conversation. It does seem like YouTube has been with us forever, but I'm reminded when I look back, it was just 2005. You know, it's less than 15 years ago or around that. It was purchased the year after by Google. And Google, you know, spent a lot of money for it, $1.65 billion. I mean, that's an idea that rocketed to the top. But revenue in 2020 with YouTube was just under $20 billion. So I think Google was pretty smart with that. YouTube has over 2 billion, with a B, active logged in monthly users. And there are lots of users who don't log in. So there's many more than that. Each day, we collectively view over 5 billion YouTube videos. And we spend a combined 1 billion hours in viewing YouTube every day worldwide. So that's YouTube, which I love. You know, I'm just going to say that right from the beginning. And then there's TikTok, which is the new kid on the block. And Beth doesn't even know or didn't know that much about it, right?
I do now.
But you do now. TikTok started in China in 2016. It didn't become available worldwide in 2018. Again, that's 4 years ago, just about 4 years ago. In September 2021, however, TikTok reported that it had passed the 1 billion, again with a B, active users worldwide number. TikTok also says that their users spend more than 850 minutes each per month on the TikTok app. And there are 160 million TikTok videos that are watched every minute. Every minute, 167 million. With the average minutes per month, by the way, that's about 14 hours or just about 30 minutes a day for their users. So clearly, these two entities, YouTube and TikTok, have struck gold or platinum or whatever. And they wield tremendous influence across every type of demographic. If you're not a YouTuber, then you're a TikToker, and many are both. What are these things, though? What is YouTube? What is TikTok? They call themselves, they're just simple, you know, just helpful video sharing platforms. They're neutral. They have, you know, they're not publishers or anything like that. They don't do any mass media. They're not really a social media exchange or marketplace like Facebook or LinkedIn. And although they're getting into streaming services, they're certainly not, you know, a network or anything like that. Of course, they're all those things. And that is one of the challenges. So I love using YouTube. I use it every day, multiple times. I use it for learning how to do something. If I'm playing guitar and I wanted to see how George Harrison plays the lead to something, I'm there, right? And that's how I learned it. I love learning about things, whether it's, you know, quarks or anything that seems to come up, I can look it up and get a YouTube video, like learning on YouTube about YouTube. And my 17-year-old granddaughter is an avid and frequent TikToker. And that's a real term, being a TikToker. Mm-hmm. And she means she both produces and consumes TikTok videos. And she's had thousands of viewers to some of her TikTok videos. So this is all good, right? And I'm going to turn to Beth first. Beth, this is, I'm sure there are some cons and pros that go back and forth, but on the whole, aren't these really amazingly wonderful and helpful services?
Yes. And also, yeah, I think there are pros and cons. I think you're absolutely right about that. So I think I'm going to start with YouTube. I want to talk about that first, because that's the platform I've really spent more time on. I use it more. So like you, Mike, I use YouTube to learn stuff. I think for me, YouTube is my new reference service. So like when I'm thinking about going out to planning stuff, you know, Brian and I are renovating his house. So we're about to go tile the bathroom. Well, we've never done that and we don't know how to do that. And so we have certain people that we like to follow and they work on house stuff. And, you know, so we watch that and we go to Home Depot and buy all the stuff and, you know, and we make it happen. And in November, I started crocheting and I had one of my good friend colleagues, Laverne, teach me how to crochet, kind of start me off. But as I wanted to make more and more complicated things, I've turned to YouTube to look at patterns and have people show me how to do more complicated stitches. And so it's been really great as a consumer of YouTube. So now I want to talk about the cons, and that's as an uploader of YouTube. So in the past, most of my use has been like going to see music shows and putting up little clips of bands for people to watch. And some of those get a fair amount of following if you're into the music that I'm into. But I started uploading videos for Rocket City Civil Rights. And last night when I uploaded our documentary, it automatically picked a thumbnail for our movie. Our movie is about civil rights in Alabama, but the thumbnail they picked was of a white guy. There's very few white people actually in the documentary. And there are interviews with white people, but you know, most of the content is of Black people. So I was like, it's really weird that this is the thumbnail. So I looked back at our other videos that other people had uploaded for us, and I noticed that was true. I noticed that was true when we had an interview with Hank Thomas, who was a freedom fighter. He worked with Martin Luther King at CORE. He came to Huntsville to lead the student protests. And in his video, they had highlighted the person that interviewed him, which was another white person, even though he was the focus of the interview. So when I went behind the scenes to look at what other thumbnails were available, all of the ones they suggested were of the interviewer, not the interviewee. And so, you know, I don't think that it was malicious, but what are the odds of that when both of those content are so predominantly Black focused for them to pick pictures of white people to represent the film? And so I'm thinking that it has to be some kind of like color saturation, contrast thing. They have some kind of algorithm or prescription of like what colors look good. And if we think about like what I talked about those oximeters not working on Black skin, well, we know facial recognition isn't great on Black people and on darker skinned people. So are these documentaries and are these thumbnails, are those algorithms overlooking Black content and focusing on other things? And so, yeah. And so that happened last night or maybe this morning around midnight where I'm like, what have I stumbled upon? And you know, I don't exactly know why. I suspect it's some kind of setting about the colors, but also it just seemed too sketchy to be random. And so that's, you know, and I think it's one thing for that to happen. It's another thing to not know that that is a problem if you're a content creator. And so if you don't know that's a problem, right, you can't correct it. And so, yeah, I mean, Dave, those were two kind of, you know, I love going to YouTube as a consumer. And then I noticed that as an uploader, as a content provider. So two different kinds of experiences. What do you think about that? Have you experienced that?
Yeah, a couple of things. It's interesting. I was listening to an article on NPR. Dave listens to NPR? Really? A white professor? It's true. And they were talking, I know, and they were talking actually about the use and now increasing federal use of machine learning and automated systems to predict and recommend parole for inmates. And it turns out, if you look at the data, by and large, these systems are recommending white inmates be paroled much sooner than black inmates. And the reason I bring that up is there is an interesting comment, and the reporter kept talking about machine bias. And clearly there's machine bias. And I kept yelling, as I do, at the speaker going, it's not machine bias. The machine didn't come up with it. It's the people who built the system.
Right.
That what we do is we encode these systems on a regular basis. And so on one level, it's sort of dubious. On the other hand, it's systemic. And so what we've seen in things like automatic selection of not just the thumbnails, we're seeing it also in the selection of videos. You see it in Netflix, for example. In Netflix, it will actually begin to show, determine your choice. And suddenly, if it decides that you're probably black, suddenly you begin seeing more black faces in the thumbnails and the video prep than otherwise. And where it comes from is probably, let's hope, no one's sitting at YouTube or Netflix going, let's get rid of all the black people in thumbnails. What's happening is they're going through and identifying good ones for whatever reason, normally. And so it's a training system. And that's when you kick into unconscious bias, you kick into a lot of different systems that come out, and then the algorithm ends up reflecting it. Facebook had that situation where when they would show an image, they would move a face to the middle or move a better picture, crop it automatically, et cetera. And they found out that they were cropping out people of color. And for me, that's what, you know, Mike, your point about the pros and cons, the algorithmic side is one of those. From the creator side, but also on the selector side. There's an absolutely fabulous, and yes, Mike, I'll send you the link, New York Times podcast series on Down the Rabbit Hole, which talks about sort of how people can become radicalized because they watch one video and it leads to the next video. And each time the video gets a little bit more extreme. So that's one. But the other one that I find really interesting, and this is a good contrast between YouTube and TikTok.
Okay.
What we have seen in copyright is we have seen the use of artificial intelligence mechanisms in digital takedowns. The idea is if you upload something, then it YouTube will scan it to see if basically you're using a piece of copyrighted music material, et cetera, and it will bounce it and you have to fix it in some way. Those that get past that initial scans, what happens is that major content holders, in the United States, seven companies own 80% of the broadcasted intellectual property in this country. They have artificial intelligence systems that are scanning poorly and automating takedown notices. So YouTube's receiving thousands and thousands and thousands of this violates my copyright, this violates my copyright, without a human ever having seen it, thought about it, or et cetera. And so it's being used as an aggressive way to preserve copyright and in some cases quell speech. Because that's another thing that you see in YouTube is you see a lot of content producers claim copyright so that if there's embarrassing material on YouTube, they can get it taken down. But when you contrast that to what's going on in TikTok, really interesting discussion about TikTok and the music industry, that TikTok and Instagram and others are really a way that people are actively engaging in the creative process, where it used to be you'd hear a song and you would listen to it and you would listen to another one. Now you get people making videos to it, remixing it, dancing, and really engaging in a different way. And what we've seen a lot in the music industry is it has shifted the control of what is popular, what is successful from a label to the teens that are listening to the music, to the 30-year-olds. In other words, the people who are engaged. So it's much less, what are we going to market, and much more about what are people taking and remixing and using it. And what TikTok has done, which is really kind of spectacular, is they've turned remixing into a legal and active community, where when you saw YouTube and when you saw hip hop, even in the early emergence pre YouTube mm-hmm. days, you know, the copyright and all this was used to basically quash this and stop it. And now they've figured out legal ways in which to do it and invite it as an interactive platform. So it's almost two different approaches to intellectual property on these two different areas.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And I will ask you to send me the reference on that, but also your reference about the seven companies that own 80%, and a reference also for your comment about TikTok. Because I think it's one of the things that this podcast does, is that we provide resources for people to follow up. And I'm just a good old librarian. That's all I am. I get that, and I see the positive and the value in that. But I mean, first of all, here's two reactions. One, Beth, I think a doctoral student or even a master's student could do a little follow-up research study to validate what you're saying and what you found. That seems to be a tendency, but to look at, you know, African-American oriented content or videos and whatever on to see whether that plays out. Because I think you're probably right, which then, you know, kind of provides evidence of what Dave is saying, which is systemic bias through the algorithms. Mm-hmm. And I love how they throw up their hands and say, it's not us, it's not people, it's just and isn't that what we've been talking about? It's what everything that has gone on for the last few years, Black Lives Matter and everything, this stuff, this is literally baked into the system. You know, it's hardwired, right? All those metaphors we use, it's not a metaphor here. That, yes, the algorithms are built around contrast. And, you know, contrast means white on dark, because it's right. easier to discern, and there is some other bias, and also get over it, you know, that whole ism. So mm-hmm. what else is there that we want to say about these platforms? One of the things that concerns me and disturbs me is their seeming stance of neutrality. That, look, all we do is provide a place for people to put this stuff up. We're not responsible for the content. We just put it out there and people choose what they want to look at or not. We don't want to censor our content, and that they have no responsibility in the same way that, say, a broadcast network does. What do you think about that?
So I think, right, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that gives those companies, right, safe harbor. And that exactly is that they are not responsible for the content that folks put up. It keeps a lot of the platforms safe. And, you know, I think the point that Dave made about these two different approaches to how are we going to keep content safe, TikTok is doing it right by using, probably through fair use, I'm going to guess, because when they have songs playing, when they have videos playing, it's just snippets, or it's two snippets mashed together. Like, it's like, you know, Britney Spears and Genuine or something like that smashed together. I'm a TikTok expert now, by the way. I think they're getting around that by snippets, right? So it's different approaches to how they're interacting with this content. So y'all know, 2 weeks ago, I had not been on TikTok. So I downloaded it and I wanted to spend some time and really tell it what I was interested in, just to see how the algorithms work. And it made me think of this story that my nephew told him, his coach, coach kind of person, you know, told him to stay off TikTok or told his whole class to stay off TikTok because it's just girls in bikinis. and it's the algorithm thing, right? It's playing you girls in bikinis because you're looking at girls in bikinis, right? Bikini. And then you liked it. And so it kept playing you girls in bikinis. That's not what my TikTok feed is at all. So, again, it's not the algorithm. It's your behavior and your interaction with the algorithm, right? And backwards on who designed it. And so I picked that I like dancing and music. And so I've really loved watching people lip sync and sing the songs. I love watching them do the dances. I am currently practicing. Mm-hmm. I can't talk Brian or my sister into becoming TikTokers with me, but I gave them 3 pitches at dinner tonight and they did actually like one. so we'll see if I can actually get them to make content with me. I've only watched, but I instantly got sucked in. So the first day I put it on, I was like, okay, I have an hour before I have to go to my first meeting. I'm going to put this on and go make coffee, get ready for my meeting. All of a sudden, it was like 8 minutes before my meeting started and I hadn't made any coffee. And I was like, what happened to that 52 minutes? I mean, it went by so fast. And so I was like, okay, this is not great. This is the first time I used it. I got completely sucked in for like a long amount of time. And I make Brian breakfast on the weekend and I started watching TikTok in bed and he got up and he started working on the house and he kept walking by and I was laying there watching videos and he said, are you still TikToking? I was like, I love it. And so anyways, that's my real concern is that like
that addictiveness
with all of the stimulation of the videos and especially because it's like cleaning and then crafts and organizing and then dancing and music. And it's all kinds of things I love. And it's really hard because it's one after another to like break away from it. It's kind of like if you watch those shows on Lifetime, how they start the next one without letting the credits go by. And that's how they get you sucked into the next one, right?
Yeah.
It was that experience. So that was my real concern is how lost you could get in it immediately.
The SNL skit guy standing up going, I don't know why this is full of gerbil porn. All it goes with gerbil porn. Right?
Exactly.
I wanted to know. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, unless you're asking for a URL for gerbil porn, in which case I'm sorry, I don't know. But really a quick clarification. The safe harbor provision isn't just sort of letting everyone off the hook. What the safe harbor provision says, which is specifically about copyright, by the way, and liability for any false information, is that they're not liable to when they put up by a user population, not directly by the individual, as long as they take it down when challenged, right? So they have to have a process by which they take it down, a review process, which is, by the way, not unlike what we're probably going to end up talking about with challenge materials and libraries, that idea that there is process. And so I think a lot of time people throw that, and particularly a certain ideology, throw these provisions around as it lets them off the hook. And the answer is it lets them build a process and they could it be better, et cetera. So that's one.
Yeah, thank
you. But the other thing that, I'm always reminded of, and I wish I could give you the site, Mike, but I don't because it's years in my head, but it was Sesame Street was supposed to change the way that we taught. Instead, it changed the way that kids learned. And I wonder when there's a drive to be more engaged and to engage more people and be more TikTok and more of this. I'm going to sound like I'm 3,000 years old, but I do wonder what it does for when people need deep engagement in topic. I don't automatically assume that it ruins people's attention spans. I mean, there are things that, it's like shuffle dancing. That's just amazing crap, how people are able to basically float with their little feet. That's incredible, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is that's candy. Keep bringing it. Fine. Oh, wait, I need to understand this topic in more depth. I'll put the time behind it. So I don't think that they're in conflict, but I do think that sometimes people look at it as an easy solution, which is, oh, we'll take was it Scott Nicholson used to talk about educational games, and he called it chocolate covered broccoli. Oh, we'll take this really unpalatable, horrible organization of information and force it down people's throat, but we'll do it in 30 second spots with a pretty background, as opposed to this is what it takes. I'm rambling. I apologize.
Well, I think that the attention span, again, is a good question. Is it a cause or is it a result? And certainly our society has sped up. Have you ever taken, you must have had this experience, Dave, with your kids, where there's a great movie that you remember and you want to share it with them, and you sit down and watch it like I did with my grandson. I said, you got to see this 2001. It's an amazing movie. It changed my life. It was unbelievable. And it's the slowest thing since, you know, watching grass grow. I mean, and he was right. It wasn't. But everything has sped up. So, and Beth, I wanted to ask you, was it your nephew you said who told you the story about the coach type thing? Well, and your nephew realized that, right? He was aware, right?
Right. And, right. All the kids were aware. Like they understand the platform better than that person did.
which is another important lesson, I think, or conclusion, that these consumers, we think they're mindless kids who are being over influenced and what they're not at all. They're very savvy consumers and they know about the efforts to manipulate, and they understand the underlying algorithms better, certainly than older people do. My granddaughter really does know this stuff pretty well. By the way, she will not let me subscribe to her feed, which is interesting. And they're really funny and cynical. And when I was allowed to, before she cut me off, particularly where she gets on her mother, who's my daughter. So, but I love the creation part of that and how they're engaged with the creation and the sharing and ways. And it's a good question, Dave, whether it can scaffold and get deeper in thought in just smaller chunks, and that they build on that. You know, if we mash up information, it kind of becomes knowledge, we hope, right? I mean, that's what we talk about, to go to the information spectrum kind of thing. And I'm going to encourage Jenna to take the infidios that she's doing on YouTube and to start to create those tiny and mini ones for TikTok, because I think it has an audience there. And I searched on TikTok for our field, and there's almost nothing. There's nothing about information, and the only things about libraries are the ones about how I love reading and I love books, and, you know, very, very traditional stuff. Or else it's some, never mind, I'm not going to talk about the bikinis and the stacks. But
I'm telling you, what takes us to 2,000 listeners is gerbil porn. That's what's going to get
us. Gerbil porn. I didn't know there was such a thing.
Sex sells. Sex sells.
Yeah, I like that. Well, we've got about maybe 5 or 10 more minutes that we can continue on this. Do you guys have any thoughts about how we might address this going further and forward as librarians? There are libraries with TikTok channels and certainly YouTube, but how can the library field be more proactive in emphasizing the pros and starting to overcome the cons?
So a couple of things. So one of the, I told you I had a couple of pitches for my family tonight about what my TikToker persona could be. And one of them is kind of doing the trending TikTok trends, but doing them for academics. So like There's one, you know, where you kind of get mad and curse somebody out. But I was like, I could curse out reviewer too. And probably lots of people would really enjoy that, right? Like just taking these things that are in general and making them about academia. And, you know, so I think that there is space there, right, for librarians too. And Mike, I think back to when we were at UW, when they made the librarians do Gaga video and they rewrote the lyrics to, I mean, it was classic. We'll have to put that resource in there, right? And just the kind of buzz and how that went viral for libraries was huge. And so I think there is potential for libraries to think about, like, how do we use this to like engage if we ignore the privacy stuff we talked about last time, but how do we use these things to engage? But I think at the very least, we need to be having, you know, tech training classes, having people understand how these platforms work, how you can use them, you know, thinking about Dave, I think back to your point of like, how might you leverage different platforms if you're trying to become an influencer? What do you use Instagram for? What do you use TikTok for? And kind of thinking about differentiating between those platforms. And I think librarians could help people kind of understand how they can utilize these things if we understand the new and embrace like the new technologies. What do you think, Dave?
You got to put two pieces together we talked about. We talked about shortest attention span. We talked about the idea of this being addictive. And what we know is that this actually is, there's a dopamine cycle in the brain that this feeds into. There's a neurological reason that we get sort of stuck for a couple hours, and it can be used for good or for evil. And I'm thinking once again, I mentioned before and I'll mention again, and yes, I'll put the reference, Scott Nicholson's work on gamification. And he was in library science. He's moved very much into social responsible gaming, doing some great work up in Canada. But he looked at lots of studies that showed that when you gamify something, right? So when you take a class, when you take an essential task, when you take an area of research, and you add all of these external dopamine hits and reward systems, you actually begin to minimize intrinsic motivation. In other words, people begin to then study and stuff that they loved, but they now begin to do it for the reward and for the feedback. And so I think we have to be aware of, yes, the privacy aspects and what libraries can do, but I think we've got to be really careful and, you know, well, if we just turn the entire world into 30-second videos, then, you know, we will have marketed effectively. And I think we can look at for marketing effectively, but I think we also have to look at educating producers of their content. You mentioned the idea of being aware of algorithmic impact. We also have to make them aware of ethical development and the use of, you know, when you're developing content, what are they going towards? How are you, you know, what's the feedback? You know, do we want libraries, you know, full of, you know, as you say, bikinis in the stack so that we can get people coming to our library website? That would not, I think, be a successful use of social media. But anyway, right. I think we have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, folks, I think we're going to have to leave it here. We'll pick up topics over and over. And actually, Beth, we'll expect you to report back on your TikTok channel and what you wind up doing. In a serious thing, I think both for fun and entertainment and for learning, I think there's a great opportunity for our field to use the medium and to listen to the people that really know how to use it well. You know, we're pretty good on YouTube because it's somewhat recognizable, a little more traditional. We're TikTok, and what's going to be next after TikTok? I know that Dave's been enamored with his Oculus and virtual worlds, and I want to talk about that in an upcoming episode. But maybe there's something related to that. Although I heard that the younger generation, you know, they all wanted Oculus at different times. They put it on twice, and then it's one of those Christmas gifts that didn't get used. But we're going to save that for another time. So we're going to take another short break, and then we're going to come back with our awesome library thingies. Thank you both for a very meaningful and interesting discussion and a little fun. So you ought to give us a little break. Okay, well, welcome back for our final segment, the awesome library thingy identification. And so we're going to start with Beth. Beth, what or who or whatever are your awesome library thingy for today?
Yeah, so I have two, and they're both pretty cool. So one of them I read in the Washington Post, and actually this got picked up by a lot of different like news organizations and parent blogs, but the Henrico Library has some desks for working parents. And what these computer stations look like, right? There is a computer station, and then there's kind of like a crib playpen kind of built along the side of the desk. So the parent can kind of be sitting in the chair, and there's like toys and books and, you know, kind of like a soft rubber mat thing, like a nap mat in the bottom. And so just kind of us, again, libraries, like thinking about what their community really needs and parents, right? Like, so there's one thing to come to story time for the library, but what happens when you have your baby and you need to like get on the computer to fill out a FEMA form or something? And so having these kinds of workstations that accommodate a single parent with a child is just so great. So shout out to Henrico Library for thinking about that and putting that service in. And then, so the other one was about a little boy, and I forget his name right now, and I feel terrible about it, but he was 8 years old and he wrote his own book. And what he knew about
That's my awesome library thing.
All right. Then I'll stop and I'll save it for you because I don't have his name, but it was just so
smart. I've got it right here.
Okay. You do it. But his book is on hold for a whole year now.
Yeah, I'll pick it up, Dave, and then I'll turn it back to you. Yeah, it's a young boy from Idaho. His name is Dylan Helbig. He's a second grader, and he wrote a Christmas adventure story, and he illustrated it and everything, and he finished it in December, and he wanted to share it with people. So he snuck into the library, past the librarians. This is the Ada County Library, the Lake Hazel branch in Boise. He went in with his grandma, and it's an 81-page book that Dylan put together, and he slipped it onto the children's picture book shelf. Nobody saw him do it. The book was titled The Adventures of Dylan Helberg's Christmas, and by Dylan himself. Pretty funny. But anyway, he later confessed to his mom what he had done. And so they returned a couple of days later, and it was missing. The book wasn't there. And they asked what happened. And the branch manager said he was surprised at the move, but they had discovered the book and they read it. And they thought it was a great book and they found it entertaining. And so what they did is they created they cataloged it and put it into the collection. It's part of the graphic novels section for kids, teens, and adults. They gave him the Houdini, Whoodini Award for Best Young Novelist, which they created just for him. And they went forth with this, and it's just a great story all around of a lifelong library user at 8 years old, somebody who got it that if he wanted his book to live on, it needs to go in the library. And he's become a minor celebrity in the community and picked up, as you said, Beth, all over the country in newspapers. Yep. So that was pretty good. And I'll put the links to it. It was in the Seattle Times, but I think it originally appeared in the Washington Post.
Yeah, I saw an interview with him and he said, "I always be sneaky." It was just so cute.
Yeah,
I love it. It's checked out for a whole year. It's on hold for a year.
Yeah.
So that's just, it's just great. Congratulations, yep. Dylan. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I think they're talking about making an ebook of it maybe so that people could share it.
Great.
Dave, what do you got?
I have a very personal library thingy, which is I want to give a shout out to the Austin Public Library. Mm-hmm. When I took this job, one of the first people I reached out to and got a lovely tour from Roosevelt Weeks, who's the director, who is freaking amazing. I mean, not just running a great library, he welcomes people when they open the library. He knows all of his employees and has things. It just, he's incredible. And when I said, "Hey, we should teach a class down here," he said, "Yes, let's do it." So tonight was our first class at the Austin Public Library. They are donating $7,800 worth of rental fees to allow us to teach this class. It's an incredible space. When we broke our students into groups, I had to go look for them, and I found most of them on the sixth floor outdoor reading area garden overlooking the sunset. And it's just like, it's a great library. But I also just want to say that there are a lot of these libraries getting into sort of the conference and organization biz. And they're doing a fantastic job of becoming a venue for the community, not simply sort of the boardroom when it's not used, but actual conference and meeting space. And so I'll give a shout out to Austin Public Library, but there are lots of good examples of that.
Oh, that's good.
And with that, I think we have awesome library thingy. So we have gone from desegregating every restaurant in the world to surviving 80 mile an hour to Mike TikToking, which is just fantastic. And we're going to conclude it first. So thank you for listening. Thank you for participating. Neil Young, please do not boycott us. We want to thank Yanni from Ace Chicago Events, our producer and sound guru. Ace Chicago Events, for event production services, including sound, lighting, photo booth in the Chicago area, or online, virtual, or streaming, go to acechicagoevents.com. Thanks to the iSchool at University of Texas at Austin for support and the Syracuse iSchool as well. Please subscribe to us and rate us on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, if you're still there, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please share a review. Very important to get the word out. Our numbers are going up. We're very excited. Let's keep it going. Contact us via email at info@librarieslead.org or our Facebook group if you decide you'd like to trade privacy for giving us input. Libraries Lead in the New Normal. By the time we're done with this podcast, we will not have any online venues that we can ethically use. It'll be perfect. Our website is www.librarieslead.org, or you can go to Joe Rogan and leave every negative comment you'd like. That's it. We're out of here. Beth, Mike, as always, a pleasure.
Next time. Bye, guys.